This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today in Cambridge, where officials say police will soon wear body cameras. The latest push in the city comes after a police shooting last month of a man who was carrying a knife in the street and appeared to be in mental health crisis. Here to tell us what it means, WBUR's Deborah Becker from the newsroom. Welcome back, Deb.
Thanks for having me.
So this latest iteration for Cambridge comes back to an incident last month, Deb. Just remind us what happened.
Well, on January 4th, Cambridge police responded to a report that a man had jumped from an apartment window and had a knife and was cutting himself with a knife and with broken glass. And they say, the police say, that they responded and they chased this man, 20-year-old, he's a 20-year-old UMass Boston student, Arif Saeed Faisal, for several blocks and were asking him to drop the knife. They used a non-lethal or less than lethal weapon, as they're called, a sponge grenade, to try to get him to drop the knife. He didn't, and then he was shot by police and later pronounced dead at the hospital.
And this is a good time for all listeners to tell you that if you or someone you know is experiencing a mental health crisis, there is a mental health suicide and crisis hotline. The number is 988. You can text or call that hotline 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So, Deb, so now we move forward to last week. Officials in Cambridge say they're going to make police there start wearing body cameras. And we know from reporting in with the local and Boston Globe that the city manager told the city council he was working on a request for a proposal for body-worn cameras in May of 2021. So this has sort of been going on for a while. What can you tell us about the history of advocacy for body cameras in Cambridge, you know, and where that kind of fits in the legacy of this in Greater Boston more broadly?
Right. Well, there has been a lot of talk about body cameras in Cambridge, at least dating back, you know, serious talk, at least dating back 5 years. And in 2020, after the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, the city did approve equipping its officers with cameras. But that never went forward. And during the recent community meetings that were held in January after Faisal's death, Cambridge City Councilor Mark McGovern said, you know, body cameras have been supported by both the former and current city police commissioners, the city's police union, several city councilors, but he said they hadn't been prioritized for funding. Now, McGovern didn't say he had a satisfactory answer as to why that never happened. He said during a 2021 budget hearing, the council was told that requests for proposals were being sent out to purchase the body camera equipment, but it didn't occur. He also said police fatal shootings in Cambridge are rare, and Faisal's shooting is believed to be the first such case in 20 years in Cambridge. So I think it wasn't really a priority until now.
So I'm zeroing in on that word, Deb, and thinking I shouldn't sort of take it for granted that it's obvious why we go from what happened in January to a renewed call for police body cameras. So connect that dot. What about the shooting in January leads to this becoming a priority now?
Well, people are very concerned. There have been several rallies and vigils, community meetings, city council meetings to discuss this. And activists say that police in Cambridge should be wearing the cameras, especially because there was this past history of support. Groups such as the Bangladesh Association of New England said, you know, cameras might have provided more information about what exactly happened when Faisal was shot. And the Middlesex County District Attorney is now investigating that shooting. We should mention that. And so there are groups who say if that information was available, there would be more clarity. Instead, there are just a lot of questions as to why this had to lead to a fatal situation. And I don't think that there are answers. There are also several calls for the city to name the officer involved, which the city has said it will not do until the investigation by the district attorney is completed. That's expected to take several months. All the city has said so far is that the officer involved is a 7-year veteran of the force, never had complaints filed regarding any kind of behavior on the part of the officer, and is now on paid administrative leave.
So I'm just going to pull back a little bit to a comment that you made earlier about a Bangladeshi association. The young man killed was from Bangladesh or was Bangladeshi. So just to put that in context. And so I want to step back here for a second now, Deb, because there's a lot that you just laid out that is ongoing. I know you'll continue to watch it. We'll continue to watch it. What struck me as we were preparing for today and starting to talk about body cameras again is it felt like we were all deeply aware in 2019 as the city of Boston began to roll them out of the basics on this. And they have been less in the public conversation in the last couple of years, even after the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. There was sort of a resurgence and then falling away again. So let's just do the basic rundown. People who want them because A. People who don't want them because B. Take us back to those basics, Deb.
Well, the folks who are advocating for body cameras say they will improve accountability and transparency on the part of police and will give the public an idea of what happened. You know, these emergencies that happen like this, they happen quickly and they're crisis situations. So folks say a camera might be able to provide an objective view of what happened rather than memory in a crisis situation. But opponents say, you know, they're not a solution. The Muslim Justice League of Boston during the community leagues in Cambridge said, you know, body cameras don't stop police shootings. They pointed to other instances of police shootings around the country, most recently Tyree Nichols in Memphis, where there was officer body camera footage. And they say, you know, cameras could provide transparency about the circumstances surrounding what happened, but, you know, they're not going to prevent this. They think that there should instead be funding for non-police response to many emergencies, especially mental health emergencies. And they're, you know, instead of more money for training and police policies, there should be a different approach.
You had said police shooting, and then you later referred to Tyree Nichols. Of course, that an instance of police violence.
Yeah, where right.
I think all those arguments are the same, Deb, whether we're talking about violence with a firearm or other means. Yes.
Right, right. It's just police activity. Do these cameras actually provide accountability and transparency? And what does that do, really? Does it address the root cause of the problem? That's what opponents say. And they also question, you know, the money to be spent on these programs, and could that money be better spent elsewhere?
We are talking with WBUR's Deb Becker from the newsroom here about Cambridge's move to prioritize, to use your word, Deb, body cameras after the shooting of a college student who appeared to be in a mental health crisis last month. And again, if you or someone you love is experiencing a mental health crisis, there's a 24/7 hotline available to you by phone or text, and that number is 988. So, Deb, you've brought up funding, you've brought up privacy. I'm intrigued that the privacy argument cuts both ways, both concerns about police officers being concerned about privacy, advocates being concerned about privacy. I noticed there was a state task force that came up with a set of recommendations last summer. And for example, one of the things that they talked about was really clear guidelines about not associating this with, let's say, facial recognition, right? So you get the transparency, but what about people who are captured on police body cameras and police usage of that information? So dive a little deeper into the privacy piece for us.
Right, right. There's concern about what happens with the footage, how it's stored, when it's accessed. There's concern that police could use cameras to record any interaction with the public, and then that footage might be used as evidence against someone when there wasn't probable cause for law enforcement to record. Opponents point to some research suggesting that much of the time that body camera footage is used in cases, it's for investigations against citizens and not police officers. And we should also mention that in 2018, Cambridge passed what's known as a surveillance technology ordinance, and that ordinance is designed basically to ensure that there's no unnecessary surveillance of citizens by law enforcement. It basically requires police to get city council approval before buying or using surveillance technology. So there are a lot of privacy concerns of what happens with this footage, and can the cameras be turned on at all times? Can bystanders be recorded? A lot of questions about what happens with this, and can it be used as evidence in a law enforcement investigation?
Deb, the other thing that you touched on was funding. Also intriguing when you look at the state task force report that came out last August, They talk about the fact that they recommend to police departments that are going to deploy these body-worn cameras that there's a significant amount of money that needs to come with it for the technology, the storage, et cetera. That's particularly interesting in this case in the city of Cambridge, where the reprioritization comes as a result of a mental health crisis call, as it appears. Because in the Defund the Police movement, a lot of the argument is that money shouldn't go to policing. In these cases, it should go to alternatives to policing that are better equipped to respond to mental health calls. So what about that kind of, I don't think dichotomy is the word, but you understand that tension. What about that tension, Deb?
Right. Well, in Cambridge, that program that I mentioned, the Holistic Emergency Alternative Response Team, is running right now. Civilians are operating that as an alternative to police responding to mental health emergencies. And there's a lot of tension, especially when there is a weapon involved. And in this case, police say that Faisal was running down the street with a weapon. When they respond to a weapon, this is what they're trained to do, and they respond in such a way to try to protect public safety, not just the person who may be having the crisis, but also members of the general public. And they say that even when these alternative responses or perhaps social workers called to a scene, even when those resources are available in a community to respond to mental health crises, police still need to be there when there's any kind of threat of danger or harm to the community, as there may have been in this case.
So the last sort of area that's intriguing here, Deb Becker, is this question of who's got access to the tapes. And it seems pretty clear that there's a legal structure developing and in place in many cases about, you know, police accountability and access to the tapes. But I am also curious about the public records dimension of this. So reporters, for example, other outside organizations interested in accountability and transparency. Is that regime sort of in place, Deb? Do we have that worked through?
I don't think we have it worked through quite yet. I think it depends on the circumstances. And in Massachusetts, the body camera footage cannot be released if it would be considered to prejudice law enforcement investigations. So there are loopholes in releasing this kind of information. The task force that you mentioned that issued recommendations last year said that there were differing views on when an officer could access the footage from body cameras. And the task force recommendation basically was that an officer could not access or view any recording of an incident before the officer was required to make a statement about it. In other words, back up what was said on the camera. And so the task force did issue some sort of vague guidelines, but I think it's a work in progress as to how this information will be accessed and who will be able to have the information that's recorded on the cameras.
All right, WBUR senior correspondent Deborah Becker, I know you're going to continue to follow that work in progress. I hope you'll come back and tell us more as you learn more.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thanks, Deb. Take a minute and really think back. Now go way back and think about some of your earliest memories of going to school. Were you excited? Were you anxious? Did you worry about what you were wearing, who you were going to talk to, whether it was safe? What do you think in those early days going to school meant for you? Well, in his new memoir, School Clothes, local author and professor Jarvis Givens collects memories of going to school from Black children in America, past and present, and through them finds a common theme that going to school, no matter what that looks like, for Black kids in America was and often still is an act of resistance. He's here in Studio 2. Jarvis Givens is an associate professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Jarvis, welcome.
Thank you.
What's your earliest memory of school?
My earliest memory of school is being dropped off at St. Timothy's Episcopal Day School in Compton, California, which is where I'm from. I remember the first day meeting my preschool teacher. Her name was Mrs. Butterfield. And my mom dropped me off, and she assured me that one of my really close friends who I grew up on the same block with was going to be there later to kind of assure me that I would be okay. But that was really the beginning of a very beautiful journey. I had a wonderful educational experience, but I remember that very first day being dropped off early in the morning at St. Timothy's.
And in your life, when did you begin to become aware that for Black kids in America, and this book really covers, I would argue, you know, roughly 1800s into mid-20th century is the meat of this book,
right,
that there was resistance in that act, that our historic approach to educating Black kids in America was politicized and was a struggle for freedom and power and control all along. When did you first become aware of that?
You know, I didn't become explicitly aware of it until I started studying and uncovering a lot of things about the history of Black education as a graduate student. When I was a graduate student at UC Berkeley, and I remember when I was in undergrad, so many folks would put statistics and sociological studies in front of me about, you know, Black student underachievement, the school-to-prison pipeline, and it didn't resonate with me because I had always attended high-achieving, predominantly Black schools in Compton my entire life, both private and public schools. But when I got to graduate school, I read a book called Their Highest Potential by a woman named Vanessa Siddle Walker, and it was about a very high-achieving Black school in rural North Carolina during the Jim Crow era. And it resonated so much with my own personal experience going to school in these very affirming, high-achieving Black educational spaces. And that was the beginning of my journey to uncover a lot of the important history about Black education before desegregation that I hadn't been informed about, that there was a lot of important empowering narratives of resistance, that, you know, Black education before Brown v. Board of Education was not only a story of separate and unequal, but there were a lot of important cultural resources and political resources and a lot of important leadership development, right? We wouldn't have the leaders of the civil rights movement had they not been cultivated in many of those segregated Black school contexts that I started to study and think more deeply about.
So part of the reason we were intrigued to do this book is that some of the stories that you collect, and you collect a wide range of stories, but some of those come from people who are strong figures in Boston history, whether it's, you know, the poet Phyllis Wheatley, or we just did a few weeks ago with Carrie Greenidge, her latest book on the Grimsky sisters and the Grimke tree, and Charlotte Fortin Grimke is key in this. When you collected stories from Boston, when you collected stories from Massachusetts, right, we pride ourselves, first public school and, you know, more advanced when it comes to segregation and freedom, et cetera, what'd you learn about us?
I learned that a lot of the politics around race and education in Boston anticipate many of the political struggles that we would see in education in the South decades later, in some cases, a century later. So things like the struggles around desegregation and the experiences of Black students in racially mixed school settings.
And to note, if I learned from your book correctly, it was mid-1800s when the Boston area schools were desegregated. Do I have that correct?
Yeah, that is correct, right.
Okay, please go ahead.
Yeah, in the 1850s. Right, and there are waves, right? There are the struggles around desegregation. It starts and stops, right, in Boston and in other places as well. But many of the things that we see, for instance, things around disciplining of Black students in the mixed schools settings in the context of Boston were quite similar. The resistance to desegregating schools that we saw happening in Boston were really happening on a much smaller scale than what we would see decades later in many of the southern states, but also the response to efforts to desegregate schools, right? So the firing of Black teachers in the rolling out of those kind of efforts, right? These are similar kinds of patterns that we see in the Northeast, and particularly in Boston, that we would also see in many southern states in the 20th century. But one of the other things that we see is a very kind of active African-American community organizing around educational politics and demanding more for their students. And also this back and forth, right? One of the things that I think is really interesting is that early on in the 1800s, you have Black communities in Boston and in parts of Connecticut as well, actually backtracking and saying, you know what, because of the way that our students are being treated in these mixed schools, we actually don't know if this is the best situation for them. So you have certain segments of the African-American community saying perhaps better resourced separate schools would be better. So you have this in in parts of Connecticut really early in the 1800s, but also in Boston.
So a tension between the push to integrate schools for equal education and those arguing, but when schools are integrated, Black kids don't get an equal education, and perhaps separate resources for schooling Black children in the region would lead to better access to resources and teaching.
Right. So there's this, and it's this back and forth that we see happening, this constant negotiation of power and racial dynamics in the context of schools. For instance, there's a case from Boston where there's a practice in some of the schools. This is in the mid 19th century, where Black students are required to sit in the back of the classroom, and misbehaving white students are required to go and sit next to the Black students as a form of punishment. Right. So essentially, in some ways, inferring that you're behaving less than you like these people here. Right. Yeah. And so as a punishment, you have to go and sit next to them. But the way in which this proximity between Blackness and discipline and punishment is something that we see manifesting in that, case from Boston in the 1850s. Right. But questions around school discipline and punishment and the criminality of, the criminalization of kind of Black students in the contemporary moment, certainly we can trace a through line between those sorts of dynamics.
So a real foreshadowing in Boston earlier of what would come in the South in the late 1800s and into the 1900s, into the 20th century.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So the book is School Clothed. And again, we're speaking with Jarvis Givens, who's an associate professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. I want us to take us back to that choice for a minute. And I'm going to ask you to read a little piece from the book. Now, I want to set this up just a little bit. This happens to be from the conclusion, but I promise it's not one of those spoiler type reads, listeners, so that you know. So we've got William Holtzclaw and his siblings, and they're kids. Mm-hmm. And they're set to give an end of year performance, and they're supposed to wear white. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, they live on the grounds of a plantation in Alabama where they work. The family doesn't have white clothes. He goes to bed knowing that there is a debate about what to do in the family. Is that a fair setup?
Absolutely.
Okay. Why don't you pick up where we marked for you from when he gets up?
All right. The next morning, Holtzclaw and his two siblings woke up to white suits for all of them. He was in disbelief at his mother's resourcefulness. She cut up and repurposed the fabric from her only petticoat, a kind of layered undergarment worn beneath Victorian-style dresses to make them flare out at the bottom. She had to be meticulous, cutting the fabric just right to ensure there was enough to cover all three of her children. The petticoat was quite worn, so the fabric was loose. The children would have to be mindful of any big movements, lest they overextend the fabric and cause it to tear. Holtzclaw and his siblings had to adjust to these constraints. Recalling his anxiety about the clothes splitting, he shared that during the performance, quote, "We had to be very careful how we stooped in moving about the stage, lest there should be a general splitting and tearing with consequences we were afraid to imagine," end quote. Knowing this, they carried on with a kind of carefulness. Despite their fears, the clothes held up. It was a proud moment for their family. Holtzclaw's mother and father, both born under slave law, were not permitted to learn. For them, reading and writing would have literally been deemed criminal activity. Seeing their children stand on a platform and perform speeches they learned in school was something like watching a prayer come to life right before their eyes.
And that, again, is Jarvis Givens reading from School Clothes, a collective memoir of Black student witness. So it touches on the clothes. It touches on the pressure for kids being educated in schools, in this case in the South, the denial of education to Black parents who had been in enslavement and then weren't. There's so much there. Why this focus on clothes as a theme, and what do you mean by witness?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that question, and also for selecting such a passage that was really important for me, because in this scenario, the clothing really takes on a metaphorical dimension for me, as it does throughout the entire book. But the focus on clothing became really important for me because I came across so many of these beautiful narratives about black students dressing up to go to school for the first time right after the Civil War, in the early years of emancipation. And for me, it symbolized something much more than just, trying to look the part, so to speak. But it really was about black students and families going to school as a way of working to kind of recreate their own identities in the afterlife of slavery, right? Trying to cultivate and support black students in defining themselves in ways that refuse the ideas about them as less intelligent, right? All of the kind of racialized myths, right, mapped onto black students' bodies, right? This kind of self-representation in my mind through clothing, right, symbolized something much larger, right? The dreams that they were covered in, right? The prayers that they were covered in, the visions of a new world that they were trying to manifest, the freedom dreams they were trying to manifest in the world. The way that they went to school was kind of aspirational in a particular way that I thought was really important. I felt found to be kind of captured in these stories, like the story of Mary McLeod Bethune when she recalls being a 13-year-old girl and all of the sharecroppers in South Carolina stopping work the day that they go to put her on a train. And she talks about them all gifting her with different articles of clothing for her to go off to this school to kind of become something that they are all hoping that she would be for herself, but also for this kind of larger vision of freedom that black folks are trying to enact in these first days of emancipation. All right, so that's really what the clothing represents for me. And there were just so many narratives that it became hard for me to avoid. And I wanted to use it because they were both beautiful stories, but also I thought that the language of school clothing took on a kind of a metaphorical dimension that was useful for talking about the stories in the book that I'm offering as a kind of covering for black students as well, right? In the contemporary moment, but all throughout kind of history, we see black students inheriting these stories that they're able to use and kind of cover themselves to make sense of the world that they're navigating as a kind of cultural armor, right? And that's how the language of school clothes, both as it's kind of reflected in the archival record and the historical sources, but also the symbolic power that it kind of takes on in the story for me.
So, Jervis, we have about a minute left, although we could have 10 hours more conversation about this. There's so much more, and we're going to play some music at the end. Singing and song is another piece of this,
right,
as well. Right. But in that last minute, for you, mm-hmm. right, this is not marked as a memoir, a collective memoir. What's the story for you now? And what do you want other people to have as the story coming out of reading this book?
That black students have a very empowering and worthy tradition in education that we can all learn something from, but that is especially an important resource for black students for their own academic and intellectual identity development, right? That there is a long heritage of education that we need to study to make sense of how power and race operates in the world around us, and that black students have been bearing witness to that. They've been documenting their experiences, and it's important that we listen to their witnessing and take it seriously.
All right. So Jarvis Givens is the author. He's an associate professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. The book is School Clothes, a collective memoir of black student witness. Worth a read. Incredibly enlightening in terms of the act of witness and resistance that going to school can be. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we are going to go out on Alicia Keys' version of Lift Every Voice and Sing. This was September 2020, posted by the NFL, and we're doing it because the use of this black national anthem turned out to be a key piece of the work of many schools in educating kids. It's a worthwhile part of the story. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
There's more ahead. This is Radio Boston. Cambridge author Celeste Ng achieved national celebrity with her second book, Little Fires Everywhere. In fact, it's now a limited series on Hulu starring Reese Witherspoon and Kerry Washington. Now, after 6 years of writing, Ng released her latest novel in October of 2022. It's called Our Missing Hearts, and it takes readers to a dystopian world that feels eerily possible. And being set in Harvard Square, it also feels very close to home. Just days after the book was released, Celeste joined us in Studio 2B to talk about Our Missing Hearts. And I started by asking her how the book has been received by readers.
Well, when you're writing a book, you're kind of by yourself, and you don't know if the things that you're writing about are things that other people will care about. You don't know if the things that you're writing will even be interesting to other people. And so it's really meaningful to get to go out and meet readers and have them say to me, this book explains something to me about my life or my family, or this book made me ask questions. That's maybe the nicest thing that a writer can hear. The sense that what you were writing actually meant something to somebody else, that's a really fantastic thing to hear.
I thought maybe what I would try is to tell you at the simplest level what I think the book is about for our listeners, and then you can tell me if I basically got it.
Okay.
Okay, so this is a story at its heart of a family. The son is separated by distance. His mother is in hiding. Because they live in a world in which there's been an economic collapse, and coming out of it, the U.S. has decided that China is the scapegoat, takes two steps. One is virulent anti-Chinese sentiment, which turns into a culture of anti-Asian sentiment in the country, and a fascist-like set of policies, including child removal for people who too vociferously disagree with the government. And it takes place, wait for it, basically in Harvard Square for a lot of the story. How'd I do?
Pretty well. I feel like that's a really good summary of the situation in the book. And that's exactly the world that Bird, who's the 12-year-old protagonist of the novel, finds himself in at the very beginning. And part of the book is about him trying to reconnect with his mother, to find his mother and understand why she left him. And that's also the story of him trying to understand the world that he's living in and how it came to be that way, and maybe how he can try and make it better.
So, you know, as I'm reading the book, and I had crashes of thoughts, oh, I want to talk to her about this, and I want to talk to her about that. So the first one is, so you started writing this book in 2016. So much of the hate in the book feels like it resonates with the COVID era, both, you know, the hate crimes and the acts of hate against undifferentiated members of the Asian and Asian American community in Boston, right, during that time. But I wonder, was this a prediction in 2016, or were you stunned when COVID comes along and now so much of what you had already started writing feels like it's playing out in our streets here?
Well, I think that as a Chinese American woman, I think that I've always been aware that this kind of violence was out there. I've seen some of it happen. I think that for most Asian Americans and really most people of color, you know the feeling that at any moment a situation could turn and someone could suddenly look at you and go, you don't belong here. What are you doing here? And so when COVID hit and we started to see all of the increase in attacks on Asian Americans, I wasn't exactly surprised. It was sort of an escalation of something that I think I'd been aware of. What was horrifying to me was seeing how out in the open it was, how some of these attacks, many of the attacks, were in the middle of the day. They were on elderly people often. And most horrifying to me was that sometimes people would just watch them happen. A lot of them got caught on videotape, and bystanders would just sort of walk by. And that was a lot of the feeling that I wanted to explore, especially in the second half of the novel, is what do we do in a situation like that? You know, when can you just walk away and say, well, that's somebody else's problem, and when does it become an us problem?
So, and I'll issue a blanket spoiler alert from this moment forward for listeners in our conversation. There is a moment in the second half of the book when Bird finds himself in New York. Mm-hmm. He looks across the street and sees a woman that he thinks might be his mother and very quickly figures out that's not my mom. But his hunger to see her makes him think it's her for a moment. And he's describing her and she's walking a dog, and out of nowhere, a man bludgeons her, just beats her to the ground, kicks her, and then kills the dog. And nobody does anything. Bird screams, the man looks at him, Bird runs off. Let me tell you why I'm bringing that up. Not only does it resonate with the things that you just said, but here's what I found myself thinking. In Boston, I could imagine people writing that off. Oh, that's New York, right? That's one of those New York stories. She wrote that in New York. I feel like the book is saying that could have been Harvard Square, not New York. And would people have been able to tolerate it here if you had told that story about us.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, one reason that I wanted to set the story in Cambridge, as you said, a lot of it takes place right around Harvard Square, partly because I live here. It's a world that I know. It's a world that I, you know, felt that I could describe. But partly it's also the world has this perception of Boston, Cambridge in particular, Harvard even more so, of being this liberal bubble where nothing bad ever happens. I think we have that impression of ourselves as well. We'd like to think that. But the truth is that racism is everywhere, and this kind of anti-Asian sentiment happens everywhere. And, you know, I've walked in my own neighborhood in Cambridge. I'm, you know, running an errand. I'm walking with my kid home from school. And I've had the experience of people leaning out their windows and just shouting slurs at me. And I think many people are horrified and surprised to hear that. And many other people are like, yeah, that's how it happens. The truth is that we're not better off than anywhere else is.
So in the things that were banging around in my head that I wanted to talk to you about with this book, another was a conversation that I had with Margaret Atwood in 2020. So she had produced the sequel to The Handmaid's Tale. It was called The Testaments. And it also takes place in Cambridge and Harvard Square. And I asked her about that choice, and she said something really specific about why she did that that made me think of you.
It would be very unlikely, you would think, but then you look back at Germany and see how quickly, once Hitler had got his hand on the levers of power, how quickly he turned it. So it was a bit of a warning. You think it can't happen here, and then it happens.
And I want to add to that, not to be political, but to underscore that you think and then it does and you think it can't. Interestingly, after the Supreme Court decision on Roe v. Wade, she made some statements, but also posted a photo of herself holding a mug that said, "I told you so." And is there an "I told you so," given that you started this book in 2016 and it's 2022 now, is there an "I told you so" in this book?
I wouldn't put it as an "I told you so." I think I would put it as, okay, so now you know. What are we going to do about it? Because I don't want to give the impression at all that I was ahead of the curve on any of these things, that I knew better than anybody else did. For me, it's more, this is an experience that I already had. And I think for so many Asians, but also for just people of color generally, if you've had that experience, you know. And if you haven't had it, you don't know. And the real question for me is not, well, why didn't you know before? But now that you do know, what will you do about it?
So that's interesting, because it also feels not only like the question that you're asking the readers, but it feels like the question that the characters are asking themselves.
Yes.
One of the things that happens, I had never felt like I really understood or connected with protest art until I read this book. And there are several guerrilla art installations, ice sculptures and yarn on trees and ping pong balls with messages, all of which are done quietly and then disappear quickly or are erased by law enforcement quickly. And as they happen, they're designed, and this is where we'll come back to, you know, our missing hearts as a thread, that phrase is a thread through them, to help raise awareness that many more children are being taken from their homes and, quote unquote, resettled, right, with more appropriate families. And it raises this awareness. And it feels like the characters, one by one, are confronted with, okay, now you know. So what are you going to do? What was it like to ask yourself in your own imagination, well, what would I do, so that you could write it into the choices the characters then make?
I'm so glad you said that, because that was the question that I was asking myself. And one of my writer friends has a saying. They say, give the problem of your novel to your novel. And what they mean by that is whatever you feel like you're wrestling with in the writing process, a lot of times that's a question that your characters need to answer in the pages of the novel as well. And so when I started writing this novel, I was looking back at periods of history in which free expression and free speech were really being curtailed, in which groups were being discriminated against, in which the government was really authoritarian. And one of the things that struck me was how much I had not known. I had known about some of these things. I had known about Japanese internment, for example, during World War II, when Japanese Americans and, you know, American-born, you know, citizens of Japanese descent were incarcerated in the desert. I had known about that, but I realized that a lot of people had not. And I learned a lot about other things that I was sort of embarrassed to not have known more about. I knew, for example, about the so-called boarding schools, the residential schools that Native American children were sent to, but I hadn't known how horrific they were. And part of that feeling is guilt. And part of that, again, I think is the question you pointed out. What are you going to do about it now that you do know? And I think that's a question we're wrestling with now.
So the U.S. Department of the Interior had a report in May, just to underscore what you just said, that found there were 408 boarding schools for indigenous children between 1819 and 1969, where children suffered forced cultural assimilation and physical abuse. And so far, they know of more than 500 children who died, to kind of underscore the realities of what you're talking about. All right, so I'm going to ask you now to read a little bit from the story. We've picked a little selection. I'll ask you to read it, and then if there's any context you want to provide around it. But this is Bird.
Sure. This is a little section where Bird, whose birth name is Noah, but he goes by the nickname Bird. He's about to have an experience. At first, it had been just a phrase, like any other. Not long after his mother left, Bird had found a slip of paper on the bus, thin as a dead butterfly's wing, in the gap between seat and wall. One of dozens. His father snatched it from his hand and crumpled it, tossed it to the floor. "Don't pick up garbage, Noah," he said. But Bird had already read the words at the top, "All our missing hearts." A phrase he'd never heard before, but that sprang up elsewhere in the months, then years, after his mother had gone. Graffitied in the bike tunnel, on the wall of the basketball court, on the plywood around a long-stalled construction site, "Don't forget our missing hearts."
A line from a poetry book of hers that gets pulled into the movement and eventually drives her into hiding, really to protect him.
Yeah.
And the first part of the book is in Bird's voice. We get into the second part, and now we're in Margaret's voice, his mother. And as a mother, I'm going to get a little emotional here, as a mother of a teenage boy, I thought, oh, no, 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 no. Do not make me go into the head of the mother here and live this through her. Your boy is Bird's age. What did it cost you to put yourself in the mind of the mother?
Yeah, when I started this novel, my son was quite young, and it took me so long to finish the novel, honestly, that he's almost caught up to Bird's age now. It was really difficult because I think, you know, one of the worst things that a parent can imagine is being separated from their child or having to be separated from their child. And writing this book was sort of an exercise in imagining what would I do? What would I take on? You know, what would have to make it worth it, so to speak, for me to leave my child behind? And that is a really difficult question. I think I would like to think, of course, I would live by my principles. I would stand up for the things that I believe are right. I'd do whatever was necessary. And the calculation gets really complicated and really difficult when your family, the people that you love most, might be put in danger. And that is the question that Margaret, Bird's mother, is asking herself in the second part of the book.
When I had to provide like a one-sentence summary for the story, I said, well, it's about hate, and it's about fascism, and it's about trust in each other. Is that right?
I think that's right, and I'm so glad that you pointed out the trust part. For me, it is about finding trust in community and hope in the face of hate and fear and everything else. It really came out of me asking myself questions during the Trump years and then during the pandemic of how do I raise a child in this kind of world? How am I supposed to tell him, okay, we're working on this, it's going to get better. How do I hold on to hope in the face of all of this? I think a lot of people have been asking themselves those questions. And so although the book does go into a dark world, for me it is about bird learning to find hope again and to find connection to his mother, to other people, to the values that his family has been trying to hold on to despite everything.
Has this book changed you writing it? And if so, how?
I think it has. It's cheating a little bit to say that every book changes me, I guess. But this one has made me ask a lot of questions to myself about how you live values versus just how you maybe speak about them, what the difference is between acting on those values and just sort of espousing them. I think we often talk to our children and we tell them how we think they should be. But one thing that I'm learning, especially as my child gets older, is that they watch you as well, right? And a lot of times the moments that you don't think that they're paying attention are the moments that make a huge impression on them. And so it really has made me think a lot about the ways that I show him how I try to live as the kind of person that I'm trying to teach him to be.
So you said the book asks readers, now you know, what do you do about it? What do you want readers to do?
I think I want people to notice, to pay attention, to not be complacent when they see things happening that they know are wrong. That sounds like such an easy thing to do, but it can be really hard. In the moment, you often are startled and you don't know what to do. But having been in situations where I've dealt with harassment or violence on both sides, I know that it makes a difference when people are not bystanders or when bystanders step in. There was a time years ago, I remember, I was on the T and there was a woman wearing hijab and a man started harassing her and just saying all kinds of vile things to her. And it was just the three of us on the train and the conductor. And the conductor was aware of the situation and was getting to the next stop and had called the police. But in the meantime, I didn't know what to do for this woman. And so I just looked at her and I just started talking to her about the weather and looking at the guy and rolling my eyes. And I hope that made a difference to her. I know that when I've been in situations like that and someone has stepped in, it made a huge difference to me to just have someone else say, I see what's happening here. You're not alone. You're not wrong in thinking this is wrong. I see it too. And so if readers, after thinking about this book, have in the back of their mind, oh, I can make a difference, even just talking to someone, even stepping in a small way can make a difference, I think that would be a good thing. I would be happy with that.
Cambridge author Celeste Ng joined us last October to talk about her latest book, Our Missing Hearts. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beeland, and Rob Lane, with Bart Tachi and John Bender. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Faladun is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.